Hello, this is Bob Anderson. You're listening to the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm Andy Clef, and I am so pleased to be joined today by our guest, Bob Anderson, who's chairman of the board of the Leadership Circle and co-author of Mastering Leadership and Scaling Leadership. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Andy. It's great to be with you.
From your online bio, I see you've dedicated most of your career to exploring the intersection between leadership and personal mastery, between competence and consciousness. You've worked with CEOs, leadership teams to help them improve their effectiveness, mostly by guiding them to gain this deep personal insight into their own creative competencies, the things that promote effective leadership and counteract their reactive tendencies, things that limit that effectiveness. And as the creator of the Leadership Circle Profile, an integrative, innovative leadership assessment tool, it's not a far stretch to say you're a true pioneer in this field of leadership development and research, bringing together the domains of business and, dare I say, spirituality. What's one of your secret superpowers that we won't find in your online bio, Bob?
I would say the gift that I've brought to all this is the ability to see patterns and integrate. So if you look at the work of the Leadership Circle, it integrates most of the best theory and research in the field, including various assessments and so on. What I am starting to actually understand now after years is that what I do best is see the patterns, how things intersect and connect, and then start weaving until it forms a coherent whole. That's just what I do. I'm in the middle of it right now with the next layer of the Leadership Circle model. We call it a universal model of leadership, and I'm actually pulling from a lot of work in mathematics, sacred geometry, and physics, because I can see there's a pattern there that lines up exquisitely with the model of leadership that emerged in the Leadership Circle. So in doing that, I have realized that the real superpower, if you will, is that ability to see patterns and integrate.
Across multiple domains of knowledge. I love the combination of math, physics, and sacred geometry.
Yeah.
You know, I read not too long ago Mastering Leadership, fantastic book, and then followed it up with Scaling Leadership, which is a 2019 title. And some of the things that I took from it that feel universal, and I want to start by diving into them. The four universal promises of leadership. And we're talking about leadership not at the C level necessarily. I think it's fractal.
Yeah.
I think it's anywhere in the organization. And these four are setting the right direction so we're doing meaningful work, engaging all the stakeholders and customers, and holding everybody accountable at some level for performance. There's a focus, the third one, a focus on ensuring that the processes and systems and tools facilitate, but not block or impede focus and execution. And then finally, maintaining these relationships of trust that lead to desired results. There's two sides of these coins. There's the reactive and the creative. And when one or more of these promises are neglected, we see things like trust and engagement and performance erodes. But if we dive into individually, you know, what are some of the tastes and smells that leaders, as well as what's the counterpoint of leaders, followers, bystanders, and opposers, you know, the team members, what do they see? What do they look for to begin to realize that there's room for improvement? So if we're looking at setting direction, you know, if leaders fail right to honor that promise, what do we see in an organization?
Misalignment, confusion, people working at cross purposes, different political agendas or silos that don't line up, or the vectors are such that they cancel each other out. On the contrary, when you do see it, you see a at the deepest level, leaders articulate a direction that is purposeful. It has meaning. I was talking with, we're in the middle of a research project, just starting a research project on really late stage leaders and beyond creative, what we call integral leadership. And how do they measure on various measures? And then how do they walk and talk? I was talking just by invitation, just to invite this woman leader into the research. She said yes. And then she said, you know why I really want to do this? That's the first thing she went to was meaning. Here's why I want to participate in this. And she went right to her children who are in their 30s in the middle of large institutions struggling with meaning. And what's the point? And one's in medical, one's a doctor in the medical system, which has all of its strengths and weaknesses, coming to a place early in career, like, what's the point? Do I really want to stay in medicine? So leaders define direction that engages people's spirit, their imagination, and it's lofty, it's worthy of our deepest commitment and our life's blood. And we align when our own deeper sense of purpose seems to be able to be fulfilled through the work of the organization. And that's how alignment, deep alignment happens. So leaders create that. And then there's a vision for that that's very strategic. And of course, out of that flows strategy. So you get lofty and strategic together. And that's direction. Of course, then it gets down into goals and execution and some of the other promises. But that is the job of the primary job of the senior team. And if it's not done, the organization flounders. I think it's in the Bible. It says, where there is no vision, the people perish, right? So
yeah. And it's a slow, you know, in the workplace, it's likely a slow perishing. Maybe it doesn't happen overnight. You talk about this leader and one of her children in the medical profession facing disengagement. You know, it takes a long time and a great deal of study to get to be a physician.
Right.
Facing disengagement, potential apathy, right? So that leads to promise number two, right? If people aren't engaged, I'm curious about the point of holding people accountable for their performance. Let's unpack that a little bit more. And, you know, the leadership promise of accountability, maybe built on trust, but tell us more about that.
Well, it's accountability with engagement. So as you know, in the Agile movement, a big component of that is, I think of Agile as the leading response to complexity in the world right now.
Bingo.
And it is actually an integration of the best of the field. In other words, the best of what used to be called quality or participation or everybody involved, best of teams, the best of engagement, the best of systems that are designed to be, you know, and so on and so forth. So Agile is a large systemic transformational process that an organization goes through to become much more innovative and adaptive to the kind of environment. And that requires engagement. And of course, in the old days, we used to call it empowerment. I was very involved with Peter Block, who brought that language into the field in the early years. And his book, The Empowered Manager, was a bestseller at the time. And of course, then everything was empowerment.
Right.
And we completely missed the boat here because on one side, people didn't really get his core argument, which is empowerment is personal. It's reclaiming the power you've given up. It's not something we can give you.
And that's so often how it's used, right? I need my manager to empower me,
right?
Which is it's a slavery situation.
Exactly. So, and then the opposite of that is, now that I'm empowered, you can't tell me no. And I don't need to be held accountable. I'm empowered, right?
Yeah.
So how do you get those two things together where you're really engaging and involving and turning over the adaptive decision-making to people lower and lower in the organization? And at the same time, they have to be accountable for performance. And that doesn't happen.
A lot of bad things happen.
A lot of bad things can happen.
You know, one of the, I forget who said this, but it was a great phrase where, you know, these teams are self-managing in an agile environment. They have autonomy, but without accountability, that's called vacation. And so I agree with you that at the leadership layer, if we start with a vision and a strategy, and then we are holding each other accountable, we can adapt to this complex environment that we're in.
Yeah, we're a very mission-driven organization, as you might expect, and also we're growing it fast. We're growing, it's crazy. We're in the problem of rapid growth, and we have to hold people accountable. Because, you know, if you're working with a large customer like a Roche Pharmaceutical or Google, they don't tolerate hiccups. They don't tolerate subpar performance. And so accountability and the mission go hand in hand and vision. So just because you're purpose driven doesn't mean there aren't also some very hard conversations around performance and results and bottom line. And
you mentioned earlier, Agile is one of the better ways of adapting or dealing with these complex adaptive systems where everything's empirical. And so when you are doing something new, you are bound to succeed and you're bound to fail. And I don't know what the ratio is. If you're lucky, it's 50-50. How are better leaders dealing with failure and accountability all in the same mix? What are you seeing?
Well, that's a tough one. Wow. I can't remember the story, but it was one of those, and this goes back years. It was written up in Tom Peters' book, In Search of Excellence, where somebody failed at like a big one. It was a multi-million dollar cost, you know, comes in, expects to be fired. And the manager asks him what he's learned. And he, of course, he's learned some lessons. Senior manager doesn't have anything to give him as a reward, like a trophy or something. He hands him a banana and says, here, I'm fired. I just, you know, spent $1 million on your learning.
Tuition.
Gave him a, like, here's a reward. So there is a different, in these great leaders, there's a different orientation. So in Agile, you're trying to fail fast, right?
Yes.
And fail fast and early. Experiments that are less risky early on. And so there is a recognition here that if you're going to be more innovative and more adaptive, you will fail. There's like, how many times did Edison fail, you know? And how could we expect we're going to be more innovative and have no failures?
Yeah. So hiccups are okay. You talked about transformations, and many of us that are loafers on the ground see transformations being attempted primarily through process and tooling.
Yep.
And I'm curious on your view on that.
Well, it's important. That layer of the system and structure does need redesign. We're often outgrow our processes, or they become patched and fixed so many times that now they're really inflexible and bureaucratic and don't work very well. So that layer of work in a transformation process, systems, structures, processes, metrics, all that stuff, financials needs to be worked. But, and I should say, what's neglected more often than not is the human side of the transformation at all levels, but principally at the leadership levels of the organization, top team and next few layers, extended leadership team. Our basic working principle is that the organization will not transform, literally will not transform unless there is a corresponding transformation leadership. The organization won't perform at a higher level in the performance of its leadership organization or system. And that since effectiveness is related to consciousness, the operating system, the meaning-making system, the decision-making system, the system that runs us both individually and collectively, how we show up, that doesn't evolve, then of course effectiveness doesn't evolve. So effectiveness and consciousness are related. So the corollary is the organization won't perform at a higher level of performance than the consciousness of its leadership. And we want to transform and not change that. And it won't happen.
Yeah. So the processes and the tooling and the accounting is not enough. So in your book, Scaling Leadership, you touch a lot on that it's a personal transformation. It's hard. It takes longer than we expect because we're adults. I don't know if you remember that video that somebody put together a bicycle and realigned how the handlebars worked. It was geared in such a way that it was reverse.
Yeah.
And as an adult, the gentleman who did the experiment spent about 6 weeks or maybe even 6 months, I forget the time frame, and eventually got it, but did some stage stuff and invited people to come up. And the older, you know, if you were beyond a certain age, 6 years old, it was virtually impossible. But the younger people would get it because they hadn't developed all that muscle memory.
Yep.
And so I imagine it's the same thing in leadership circles. People that have spent a career, decades, multiple decades, developing the capacity and the capabilities and the behaviors that got them there, but now they need to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So what are some of the models, whether it's change management or management of change at the human level that you've experimented with that you see promising or the opposite side, bound to fail?
Yeah. So I'm going to go back to earlier in my career where because I was working on this empowerment work from the inside out, I actually got pulled into some very progressive change efforts with some leaders that were really trying to do some bold stuff. In healthcare, it was reinvent healthcare, and it was an amazing systemic restructuring of how healthcare gets done, or at least how a hospital would operate, and so on. And anyway, I don't need to get into their vision, but these were very visionary leaders that I got up close to, and more often than not, they continued to lead the same autocratic top-down way while championing a vision of engagement, empowerment, involvement, and so on. And they didn't see it.
They didn't see it, yet everybody else did. And
everybody else did, and they wouldn't tell him or her. So it was the emperor had no clothes, and one layer below the CEO who's committed to the vision. I mean, that was not an issue. They were not lukewarm about it. You would hear conversations like, well, nobody's really serious around here, or, you know, I'm going to wait and see until she starts walking the talk, or, you know. And so I realized that we had to get more feedback and truth telling in the system. And so partly you can get that if you can really open up and get a group of senior leaders really where they can get really honest with each other and get really good at those tough conversations. So that was an angle. That's why Peter Block's work on authenticity was really, that's what he was about, is how do you get positive politics? How do you get the real conversation out of the bathroom and into the meeting room? Want to know how people really feel? Just go in the bathroom and hide out in there. And you'll hear the conversation that's going on, at least in half of the organization. Then you go in the meeting, how's it going? Great, fine. Milestones, objectives. That's not what you heard in the bathroom. So I then got into feedback and 360 as a way to get that conversation up. And then, of course, as I got into that, I began to see that most of the 360s were only marginally helpful to get at the deeper issues of what ran patriarchy, or the deeper assumptions, or the consciousness layer, the psychological layer that ran a leader. And until you really got some deeper insight into how they behave moment to moment, what was running that, you didn't really get breakthroughs in behavior, or that's what generated the leadership circle. But I got to create one because there isn't one out there that does that. You can get psychological measures, but you can get competency measures, but you couldn't get both in one assessment. And so that's where the integration started happening. So, but feedback would be one of those elements. How do you harvest your feedback rich environment? One of the things that struck us in the research we did on scaling leadership, what we did there was we have a database of, I don't know what it was at the time we wrote the book, but it's now probably 200,000 leaders around the world, all of whom have a 360. And most of whom have written comments in there about, here's what you're doing that makes you effective, and here's what you're doing that gets in your way. Here's the challenges you're facing as a leader. And we analyzed that database and we sampled for higher, more senior leaders because we wanted complex environments and we wanted to see how do senior leaders talk to other senior leaders about what works and what doesn't. We were struck by how precise they were and how precisely their data, the written data when analyzed, matched our quantitative data that the model would predict.
Fascinating.
So leaders see it and they can describe it. We've said for years that leadership is the most studied and least understood. I don't think that's true anymore. I think it's been well studied and we've learned a lot. And leaders can now describe very precisely, here's what you're doing that's working and what you're doing that's not working. So we're in a feedback-rich environment. We don't have to create one. What we have to do is help that conversation happen or harvest the feedback-rich environment. So everything we do, whether it be one 360 assessment and a debrief to a two-year-long cohort learning process, everything we do builds in feedback.
I'm curious. So if we look at the organization at any scale as, say, an organism,
yes.
there's a DNA there. And you're providing through this tooling and data samples from other places, a mirror in a sense,
yep.
Right? Here's where you appear to be. And then you're saying, and we're going to change your DNA.
Yes.
And how do you begin to create an environment where that's possible? When so many people are constantly underwater, so many have difficulty saying, I don't know, the three hardest words in corporate America, combined with a 24/7, always on, no time to grow, you know, I, almost in the sense, you know, I wonder if Dr. Peter was right, or you're finding he was wrong, that in his principle, we rise to the level of our incompetency, and then we stay there. Your proposal and your system is showing that that's not true. As adults,
yeah,
we can grow and change. But how do you face almost what you called it, the terrible truth number one? We have identified the problem. It's you.
Yeah.
It's me. It's not the process. It's not the system. It is me.
Yeah.
Where do you start, right? Before the call, we were talking about diving and being in water. And the fish doesn't know it's in water. This is a way of letting the leader know they're in water and there's viscosity.
Yep.
So what do they do?
What we find, and I would, you quoted our research, so let me start there. We find extraordinary competence at senior levels. And what we found in our research for scaling leadership is that at the level of capability, raw intelligence, brilliance, creativity, results focus, domain knowledge, all that stuff, the most effective leaders and the least effective leaders were described similarly, amazingly similarly. What differentiated them was a bunch of other stuff, and mostly having to do with relationships, capability, team. So you take your technical capability, how do you augment that with relational capability at one-on-one, one-on-team, and then one-on organization? And then the rest had to do with what we talked about earlier, vision and authenticity, drive and direction, and then the kind of walk the talk, high integrity leadership. That was how the most effective leaders were described. And so what we see when we're working with leaders, they're not reaching limits oftentimes, more often than not, at the level of their capability. They're reaching limits within their inner game, their operating system, that has them habitually showing up in ways that are not complex enough or suboptimal to the complexity that they've now grown into. And it isn't that they lack the requisite skill, and if they do, they can often learn it. Sometimes that's the case, and there's a change that needs to be made. But more often than not, they're running into the limits of what we call reactive leadership or reactive mind, and that has them stuck in old patterns of behavior that are just inadequate. They're not adapted. You use the word adaptive. They're not adapted yet for the complexity that they're now in or moving into.
But part of the trouble, I imagine, is that these leaders have gotten results historically.
Yes.
Extraordinary results, right?
They may still be getting extraordinary results because they're brilliant and they don't get to these levels without that.
And they often don't care about the trail of broken, disenchanted, disengaged employees that they've left behind because they are so results focused. So how do you help them see that those strengths that got them there are really liabilities?
They've become liabilities in their overuse. You've doubled down on them and now it's becoming a liability. So that's an individual conversation depending on how a leader is showing up. So for example, I think we use this in one of our books, but we walk into a coaching session. First thing this chief operating officer runs a large chunk of the organization, just got promoted to running a much larger chunk of the organization. So literally has a team of 20 people, nobody in the same country now. 75% of the revenue of this Fortune 100 company.
That's the prize for doing so well as a reactive leader.
His superpower, we started with that. His superpower was he could manage all of it. He could be on top of all the detail, run all decisions, and everything went through him. And he was now at a level of complexity where that was no longer even remotely possible.
The expert archetype.
Yes. Well, and we walk in the room. He's got a fairly autocratic, arrogant kind of profile. And we walk in the room. One of the first things he says is, look, you're not going to get a hug from me when we're done here, because I'm not that kind of person and I'm not going to become that kind of person. So the code was, I'm not going to become one of these touchy-feely relational types. So, you know, as long as we're not going there, let's have a conversation. Well, he had really low scores on the relationship and really high scores on high control and so on. So he also had a really low score on balance, work-life balance, really low. So we, you know, looking at that, just said, well, you've reached limits to scale. You're reaching limits to scale your leadership. That got his attention. What do you mean by that? How do you see that in this? Well, here's how you're leading. Here's how you're not leading. Here's how late you, how many hours are you working? Well, pretty much we got a 24/7 answer, right?
Yeah.
And you just 4X your responsibility. How do you scale? You're already 24/7. How are you going to scale to that? Now, that's not the argument with every leader. That just was the argument with this leader. Now we got his attention. And that conversation over time can work its way into, how do you make up that you have to control every decision? How do you really get some insight into the fact that because that has been your superpower, it's brought you where you are, that you're identified with it. You think you have to do that in order to be an effective, worthwhile leader. So your identity is all caught up with being that. And if I'm not that, I don't know where my value lies.
Right.
Right. And so how do I add value if I'm not the one who can be in control on top of everything, make sure everything's works and so on. So the deeper work where he's running into limits is not that he doesn't know enough. He's not smart enough. He's not creative enough. He's actually brilliant. He's running into the limits of the bicycle he learned to ride, you know.
Right.
Right. And it doesn't work anymore this way, or I've reached the limits of what that can do. And I've got to learn new ways of leading, which go right to the core of how he's organized his sense of self-worth, identity. All of that goes up for grabs. And so you have to work with the leader at that level and understand it's an inherently vulnerable process. But if it doesn't transform, I'm going to continue to show up the way I have shown up. And all of this, quote, agile transformation stuff, I'm now going to be in the way of it, even though I am supportive of it.
What we're seeing in the field is what happens when there's not recognition that I'm the one in the way, that this agile thing, the agile, is the problem.
Yes.
It wasn't done right, or the people don't get it. But there's a level that's not harvesting the feedback or seeing the feedback in a way that forces us into this crucible that you described with this particular individual, that I've hit my limit, but and you found a way to communicate with them.
Well, that's the art of our work, with any leader is, where is their leading edge and how do I approach it without judgment? I mean, here's a brilliant guy. Wow. I'm here to be of service, right? And how do I find a place where he might really want to grow and develop? And of course, the story on this guy is that he's really gotten clear that team and team on teams is the solution to his scale ability to scale himself. So he's worked really hard on developing capability within his team. And then that group chartered to build capability within their team. So he's leading through teams now in a way that is very, very different. The catch was, I got to scale because I care about results and I can't scale to this. And so we work kind of in an Aikido way with, here's a guy that's all about results. You can't say, go to charm school and become a touchy-feely type. That is not going to happen. But how do I get better results? That's a conversation. And scale to that, that's a conversation that's open. In the process, I've got to get good at developing people, and he's taken to it.
I love it. It's sort of an oblique approach to the problems. The solution is identifying what's of value. Are these changes, are they growth? Is it metamorphosis in the sense that there's disintegration of old identity and reintegration into a new one? Is it a combo of all the above?
Both. So there's growth, you know, if you're working at a certain level, there's growth that happens or incremental, and all of a sudden there is a metamorphosis that can happen, that the whole way I understood myself as a leader is radically different. So we were working with chief operating officer, CFO, in about a $10 billion company. We now have our fourth leadership circle profile on him over 10 years.
10 years. Wow.
This is long-term work. And leaders who get it and sign up for it, it's like, well, I'm going to be in this the rest of my life because I can always get more effective. And that's when we started with him, again, very brilliant guy, really sharp, smartest guy in the room, and everybody needed to know it. He was strategically brilliant, financially brilliant, big part of the organization's success, and tough guy to work with. And that was fine as they were growing. This was a startup company, and then the recession hit, and it's a financial industry business, and so they ended up doubling down on their react. He doubled down in his reactive leadership style. And on his second profile, he'd gone from an 80 percentile leader on effectiveness down to 30. So a big swing. So people saying, you're no longer effective. And a lot of his other scores that would be related to effectiveness had come in, especially relationship scores. And that got his attention. Oh, I didn't pay attention 2 years ago. Business is failing. And here's what's happened to my leadership. This has my attention. He took it on. Next profile was considerably better. And then he left and became the CEO of another business. It wasn't a startup business. It was a business that was flat. And the board finally said, we need a change of leadership. They brought him in. 2 years in, his profile was a 90% effectiveness profile. And very, very filled out on both the visionary strategic side and the relational side. Still had a streak of arrogance in there, but he, when you talk to him or watch him in action, he would say, look, I know this sounds arrogant and that my mind's made up, but it's really not. Here's where I'm coming from on this. Please challenge me. So there was a whole different way he held that.
Yeah.
And people loved working with him. Describe it as the best leadership experience of their life. And they 4X the value of the company in a few years. So this is what's possible, but we have him on video, and it's really interesting because he talks about on that the first profile that he got back, and he said, you know, I didn't think any of that really applied to me. Like, I didn't need it. I'm a successful guy, and I didn't need it. And then he looks up with a kind of wry sense of humor, and he says, that's the kind of thing you miss when you're as arrogant as I am.
I love it.
And now it's not like I'm the problem. It's like, yeah, I'm the problem, you know. I have a lot to learn. And so there's a lightness about it. How can you, if stuff isn't happening around you, how can it not be? How can you not be the problem?
And it's wonderful that he is willing to be the first one to say, yep, I'm part of the problem, which makes it safer for everybody else to say, yeah, I have a little growth to do as well.
The best leaders we see that really do transform their organization, that start an agile effort and succeed in really transforming it, have to transform the culture to support that kind of transformation, both structure, processes, culture. But behind that is transforming the leadership in the organization. And behind that is, I'm the problem. So I have to take this on personally. And that, where we see that happening, where the senior leader becomes the CEO or the senior leader of the division or whatever the organization is you're working with, when the senior leader takes that on and says, I'm the chief development officer here, I'm responsible for leadership and its effectiveness as a individually and collectively in the organization. I get help from HR, but that's not their responsibility. I'm responsible for building that collective effectiveness, and it starts with me. And if it doesn't start with me, it won't happen. Therefore, I'm on the journey. I'm willing to learn out loud. There's stuff I don't know. There's stuff I have to learn. I need feedback. When I start that and take it on, it does create permission, as you said, and safety for others to join. And then there's a then it moves to the team level. It doesn't necessarily have to be sequential, but
yeah.
And then the senior team gets invited in, and then you're in a very different conversation.
I want to come back to this story of this leader who over, you've got 10 years, and also roll it into the concept that organization as organism, organic nature of this human system. Many systems, there's a homeostasis, a desire to return to some place. You described this leader and some of the oscillations that went through as different pressures happened, reverting to a more reactive stage, and then gradually or even liminally or maybe quantumly showing up with the next stage of leadership development, creative. So how to deal with that natural tendency of systems to not fight change, react with adversity to change?
They're actually, yeah, you're right. I think they're designed to resist change. And that is a good thing and problematic if you're trying to change it. So you want the body, it's similarly, the body maintains a homeostasis. If it didn't, you would die. So there's this, how do I change it or grow it, evolve it, get more healthy or whatever? And at the same time, there's a wanting to return to homeostasis. Those kind of structures are built into organizations. We want them to perform predictably, reliably, on time, every time. We build structures and processes and all kinds of stuff in to get that kind of result. And then we say, now let's change it. And it's designed a certain way, so it's going to push back. And as Kurt Lewin, one of the founders of the whole field of organization development says, you don't really understand a system until you try to change it. And then it pushes back, and then you start to understand the system. So that's inevitable. It's not wrong. It's inevitable. And it's inevitable for me, too. There will be resistance to change or a pushback from the system. I've spent my whole life designing it. It's brought me to where I am. It's made me effective. And so on. Why wouldn't it push back? It will. And so, like with this leader that we talk about, and I think we mentioned his name in the book, but I won't mention his name here because I can't recall. It didn't apply to me. And didn't actually start to take it seriously for 2 years. So a lot of times we'll see the real diving in of leaders on their second profile, where they really say, okay, okay, now it applies to me. So oftentimes the initial wave is resistance or a reset to normal. You're working with that all the time.
Yeah.
In me. I mean, I look at the relationships that I have with my partner, Bill, and man, we've worked it through a really great place, but there were a lot of stuff we had to look at. It took some time to work through together because we're both really strong-willed. And so there's, you can either get that really working or you can do this.
Yeah, you really butt your heads. So we've got reactive, we've got creative. Is creative leadership sufficient for today's highly interconnected complexity? Is it enough?
No. Short answer, no. And now this is the hard news part of the conversation, because 75% of adults or more are running the underpinnings of a reactive leadership, what Bob Keegan at Harvard called socialized mind, meaning I'm leading from the outside in. My sense of identity, self-worth is made up by you, those around me, the voices from my past, these, my conditioning. This runs me more than I know. So we're more authored by others than we are authored by self. So when I talked about the leader whose identity was, I'm the guy that gets results and can be on top of everything, that's a conditioned response. He's going to have to break through that to know, that's not me. I'm just good at that. And I'm good at it and I can use it. But if I overuse it, it's not enough. And I need to construct a new identity. And that is the move to the creative, and where you're more authored by self than authored by others. This allows you as a leader to author the vision, the purpose where we start, a purposeful vision and so on, to hold each other accountable in ways, to have conversations that are risky, as opposed to, no, I'm not the problem and you're the problem and we can't have that conversation because if I really told you the truth, it would, we'd get shot. All that stuff that goes on is vintage reactive level. Once you are not so defined by what other people think of you and expect of you, you can step into what are more courageous, direct, authentic conversations, and so on. That's minimal requirement for agile and for the complexity we're in. And only generously, 20% of adults are operating from that mindset, from that operating system. So there's a huge developmental imperative that we're facing in every organization. And I think, and this is part of our research that we're into now on integral leadership, the next evolution of it is what's required. We may be actually moving to a place where this creative leadership, which has been well described in the literature, is actually still not mature enough for the complexity we're in. It's minimal system specs, but not necessarily mature enough.
It's interesting. 75-25 is the same ratio of agile transformations that fail and succeed.
Right.
Not necessarily causality, but certainly a place to go look.
Pattern on pattern, right?
Yeah. a couple more questions and then we'll wrap up. We see in our industry still underrepresented groups in leadership, the lack of diversity. Does this model help? Does it address some of these issues? Does it create the fertile ground for further evolution?
Yeah.
And retirement of diversity issues?
I think so.
In what way?
Well, let me build it a couple of ways. One of the things we found in our research on the scaling book was we sampled our norm base, right? And we sampled it for really high creative leaders and really high reactive leaders, senior leaders. And we did a representative sample of those two groups. Our norm base is about 40% women overall. In the high creative group, they were about 55% of the high creative group and only 28% of the high reactive group. So women are showing up more often as creative or high creative leaders than are men. When you look at the description in writing of what makes the most effective leaders effective, 6 out of the top 10 most commented upon strengths had to do with people and teams and developing of people and so on, holding them accountable and so on. So women are bringing an important corrective, I think, to leadership. And it's time that that be recognized, valued, paid, promoted, all that stuff. So I do think that's one response to your question that at least from a gender standpoint, we're starting to see, and I don't know that we have enough data yet or we've sifted it to be able to see about ethnicity here, different ethnic groups, but from gender standpoint, women's contribution to leadership has been marginalized and way underestimated. Then the second thing I would say is the natural movement from early development into later stage development. This is psychological and spiritual language because the spiritual traditions had these same models of human development. In the traditions, in the monastic traditions, for example, east, west, north, south, you move from a more black and white in your thinking, us and them, they are good, we are good, they are not good, ethnocentrism, you know. So if you look at, and the more mature, the more you move into creative and integral, or the less you see opposites like that and hold them in black and white threats. So when you look at the integral leader, they're much less likely to see you as an enemy. They're much more likely to say, we've met the enemy and they are us. You're not so different. This was Gorbachev when he went to meet Reagan, you know.
Right.
We're not, I'm here to deprive you of an enemy. Why? Because you build bombs and we build bombs. We're not that different. We build bigger bombs and so on.
Yeah, that story about how Gorbachev completely changed the conversation, right?
Right. Well,
just by saying we are the same. And yeah. and is that a manifestation of creative?
I think it's integral.
Integral.
I think it's even more mature than creative. Remember, he came out of communism, very, you know, that would be really conventional. In the sense of the way communism was structured, very bureaucratic, very rigid. And he led perestroika. He pulled it apart and created, you know, freedom and began really the dismantlement of the Soviet Union in many ways. And then he meets Reagan after that, or as that was proceeding, and he says, look, I'm here to deprive you of an enemy. So I think he was a systems thinker. I think he saw the larger system. He wasn't willing to turn you into an enemy. So all that's a way, going back to your original question, at the later stages, who's my neighbor? Well, who's not my neighbor? At the earlier stages, you're the infidel and it's my God-given responsibility to kill you. I mean, that's not religious. We're now blaming Muslims or that, but that's not religious. That's a level of consciousness.
Right.
Right?
Tribal thinking.
Tribal, ethnic cleansing goes on all over the world. At early stages of development, we do not embrace our diversity. At the highest level of development, we're all one.
Right.
The divine is dancing in diversity as one.
And every tradition has that concept, at least the ones
every
I'm aware
tradition.
Of.
Including the indigenous, you know, the ones we may be less familiar with, the indigenous traditions had that same understanding of
connectivity, right?
Connectivity and the unity that's inherent in everything. And diversity is its, the way I think of it now is we're the divine, you know, everything is dancing, this exquisite diversity is dancing on a stage of unity. So that would be the mystic's awareness. So that would be the highest level of development. So
we've got one beyond integral. So we've got reactive, creative, integral.
And various levels of what would be unitive consciousness. Mm. In the spiritual traditions, integral would be like third on a, you know, out of seven. So
we got a long ways to go, don't we?
Well, it's kind of infinite, I think. So, but they become more unitive as you go, and therefore more accepting, if not embracing, of diversity as inherently exquisitely beautiful, as opposed to something that needs to be stamped out or separated out. So we're in that right now. We're in a very early in our conversations around diversity in this country. We're in a very early level of development around that conversation, because we're in some cases, if it's really early, it's white supremacist, and it's saying one race is higher than the other race, and we don't want to live together. At the mystics level, and well before that, that argument is seen through altogether.
Yeah. I wonder what it'll take to help catalyze a larger growth into that arena.
Well, it takes that kind of evolution of consciousness. And this is the beauty for me of that lens. Once you start to really see the world through a lens of a developmental framework, that there are structures of consciousness, just like DOS and Windows and Windows 10, when you start to see and how they operate, then you can say, well, that kind of reasoning, that argument is much more DOS. It's much more socialized, or even pre-socialized level of development. And then the level of development gets more and more complex. So I was watching the news the other night, and I won't mention political names and figures.
You're fine. None of our broadcasts are safe for work to begin with, so our listeners wouldn't be offended either way.
But they were interviewing someone, just a guy off the street. And he said, well, the reason I like this candidate is because you don't have to solve a puzzle to figure out what they're talking about. They just talk plain language. And my wife had one reaction to that, and I went, that's really interesting. What was interesting to me was he's talking from a level of development, which is, in his case, his real world. It's a real world. If you don't speak to that real world, you're talking in a way I literally don't understand. I can't follow it. You're asking me to solve a puzzle I can't solve. Mm-hmm. So the meaning-making system is at a level, and everything makes sense at that level. And at earlier levels, white supremacy, at very early levels, white supremacy makes sense. There's an order here. Whether it's Muslim against Hindu or Christians against Muslim, and the, it's not religion, it's consciousness, and how consciousness polarizes at earlier stages versus finds unity or commonality in our difference, or can hold difference in a way for higher order resolution to break through, or reconciliation. King was an
magnificent at that. Yeah.
Integral and beyond leader. Integral, and we call it integral informed by grace, because it starts to be informed by a larger unity when it gets very integral. And he was that kind of thinker. And so even with some of his most ardent opponents, like Stokely Carmichael, who founded the Black Panther movement, and it was a violent movement, and King was trying to advocate nonviolent transformation, he and Stokely Carmichael could sit and talk. And you'd see him walking and talking together. People say, how can you talk to me? So why wouldn't I? I want to understand how he comes to his perspective.
And not dismiss it.
In fact, if you read some of his books, he can give a brilliant argument for why Stokely Carmichael's rallying cry of Black Panthers makes sense.
I love that in debate to switch roles and assume the others and find what's right, not necessarily what's wrong. And I think perhaps that's some of the skills that we're lacking.
When we're in complex issues with really differences of opinion and diversity, you have to be able to do that in order to create higher order solutions.
Exactly.
And so development is required.
Yeah. Well, Bob, this has been a wonderful conversation, weaving together all these different thoughts. We should wrap it up, let you get back to your vinyl. an inside joke between the two of us, and maybe I'll fill you in afterwards.
You might want to explain that. They'll think I'm sniffing vinyl or something.
Those new records, when they come out of the sleeve, have a beautiful smell that you don't get on the CDs or your MP3 downloads. The power of sense and smell and memory. Bob, what are some of the best ways for our listeners to get in touch with you, to continue the conversation, learn more about LCP and the additional work you do?
LeadershipCircle.com. Awesome. One word, LeadershipCircle.com. And that's one of our websites, but
that's the best place to go.
And a contact form there, and somebody will get in touch with you. That's the best place.
Thanks again, Bob. for your time. And to you, our listening audience, if you enjoyed this show, please give us a review, a rating, or leave some comments on your podcast platform of choice. It really helps others find us. If you'd like to join the discussion and share your stories about upgrading your own internal operating system and other things like good craft beer, join us at coalition.agileuprising.com. And finally, support from listeners just like you. Help us cover our hosting and production costs. So see our show notes for how you can be a patron.
Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.